Gary Cohn, the 11th director of the National Economic Council and former president and chief operating officer at Goldman Sachs, struggled as a student because of dyslexia. But he tells us how the challenges he faced helped him learn about risk and how not to fear failure.
I don't think anyone succeeds in this life without failing many times. As I've told many people, bad things are going to happen to everyone. It really what changes your path is how you react to it. Like when something bad happens, is it going to alter your life negatively or alter your life positively? Is it a learning experience? Is it a teaching moment? Or is it a moment where you like start questioning everything?
He tells us about his journey and how he adapted as a student on the road to his role in the White House. We also discuss the technology that's moving the world forward and the opportunities that could come from it. I'm Andrew Kaufman, and this is The Strategist, presented by the George W. Bush Presidential Center. Welcome to Gary Cohn, Vice Chairman at IBM and 11th Director of the National Economic Council during the Trump administration. Gary, thanks for coming straight off the main stage here at the 2022 Forum on Leadership to keep the conversation going.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and our co-host today is Dr. Cullum Clark, director at the Bush Institute SMU Economic Growth Initiative, and he's also a professor of economics at SMU. Professor Clark, thank you for spending a little time.
Great to be joining the conversation.
This is your first time to co-host also. And Crystal, earlier today was our first.
Yes, it is. You're taking a risk on me.
No risk whatsoever. So, Gary, we love looking at leaders' journeys and how different paths can inspire people in different ways and everybody's path is unique and unexpected. Can you tell us some about your early life in Shaker Heights, Ohio?
So my path is probably as unique and unexpected as possible.
Well, perfect. We've got 20 minutes to talk about it.
you may need longer. So I'll give you the quick version. So as you point out, I grew up in just outside of Cleveland, Ohio. I am first generation college educated. My grandparents immigrated to the United States, which is the sort of end of the story. But I was a very difficult kid in my early academic life. As we were talking a second ago, I was dyslexic growing up, highly dyslexic, in the early 60s. When dyslexia was not as well known or well talked about in a public school setting in Cleveland, Ohio, and was a fairly painful experience having to go through the process of living that life.
Right.
Couldn't read, couldn't write. Teachers always assumed I was just lazy. And, you know, my parents were concerned, so they would have me do all types of things where I would do IQ tests and intelligence tests, and I would score higher than you're supposed to score.
Right.
And so then you'd go back to the classroom, and they go, well, of course, we told you your son's lazy.
Right.
Oh, and so
right. That's not right.
You could never put it all together. So I ended up sort of in the system of getting bounced from school to school to school,
right?
Which is interesting, and ended up at a interesting place in a Catholic school, and they had just decided to open up a middle school, a seventh grade, and I ended up in a Catholic school where they sort of knew they were getting someone with some learning disabilities, and they were willing to take me on, and I give them an enormous amount of credit. So, you know, the brothers sort of, you know, they were pretty disciplined on me, and the discipline helped. It didn't make me read anymore.
Right.
But, you know, it did make me try and concentrate and learn a little bit. So, you know, miraculously, I somehow graduated high school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not with great grades. Don't be confused.
D stands for diploma.
As I always say, D's get degrees.
That's right.
And my kids tell me today, D's do not get degrees. When I say at home now, D's get degrees, they go, Dad, C's get degrees today.
Oh.
I go, damn.
Got harder out there.
Yeah, it got harder out there. So miraculously, I got into college. I went to American University. And, you know, it's interesting when you go to college, it's a fresh new start. No one knows who you are. No one knows what you can and what you can't do. And I tell this to a lot of people that have grown up, you know, with learning issues. And all of a sudden, you know, you think about college and what do you, you go to class like 6 hours a week, six, if you think about it, you go to college 6 hours a week. I go, you know, I go to class 6 hours a week. If I actually go to class and I listen and I'm very, I listen really well.
You absorb it.
I absorb. I have to be an absorber. And you listen really well and you take some notes and you're willing to spend time sort of looking through the book and, you know, read, but I don't absorb a lot and just keep going through it, just keep going through it and talk about people in the class with what's going on. And office hours were my best friend. I love office hours in college.
Well, smart. You found a way to,
So I went to, you know, there wasn't a professor that didn't see me every office hour that they had office hours. And they also feel sorry for you too. Because when you come to office hours,
they're happy to see somebody.
Yeah, they're happy to see someone. So, you know, I actually figured out a way to get through college with relatively good grades, which was a phenomena for me. So went from a relatively poor student to a, I wouldn't say a phenomenal student, but a pretty acceptable student, and graduated college miraculously.
But and you found things that worked for you.
Yeah, which was, I think, my mom's highlight of her career, because she was told when I was, you know, 11 or 12 that we'd be lucky if I grew up to be a truck driver.
Right.
So, interesting.
And she probably didn't foresee the director of the National Economic Council.
No, I don't think she saw the director of the National Economic Council. I don't think she saw me being president and chief operating officer of Goldman Sachs. I don't think she saw a lot of those things.
But to get before you get there, though, you had to start that career, which and the story is well told, but I think it's still great to hear it in your words. Is there was a fearlessness there? So how did that kick off?
Well, look, there was a fearlessness there in. What I sort of attribute my success to is I am the world's best failure. I learned how to fail so many times young in my life. Like, failure was the expected outcome for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, early in my academic career, early in my life, I was going to take a test. Well, there's no way I was going to pass it. Like, I was going to get, you know, 20 out of 100, 30 out of 100, maybe. So I was going to fail. So I became very comfortable, not satisfied, but comfortable with failure. So it never demotivated me because in my mind, I was trying really hard, contrary to what everyone else is thinking.
Right.
You know, I remember the pain of going to sleep at night, knowing how hard I was trying, other people not realizing it. You know, I shouldn't say other people not realizing it. I did have a grandfather who sort of realized it. And I could tell you that story, but I did have a grandfather that realized it, who sort of was my backbone of my youth.
Right.
So I realized I was working hard, but it was just the outcome. So I understood what it meant to fail. So when you learn that failure is okay, and the sun comes up in the east the next day, and it sets in the west, and everything will be okay. And I think this is a much bigger issue today, and I see it in a lot of people I mentor and a lot of younger people, the younger generations today, that they don't understand failure. So it allowed me, you know, to take enormous amount of risk in my personal career and things I did, and it allowed me to get into places that, you know, without having the self-esteem to go in and try,
right?
Because I didn't really think about the ramifications of failing, because failure was sort of par for the course.
But it's so fascinating how the things that happen to you that are so trying for so long become what makes you who you are later on in life.
Right. It's like, who jumps in a taxi cab with a complete stranger and talks themselves into the first job and tells them they know how to do the job when literally they have zero knowledge? I did it.
I did it.
But it's when you think back on it, it's like, really?
So you managed to press your way into options trading,
mm-hmm.
and the rest is history, as they say, and you had an amazing career at Goldman Sachs. I'd love to ask a question or two about that, actually. So Goldman Sachs, I think, would have a reputation as having, among other things, probably the world's premier Wall Street trading operation, and you've been a trader. So I think for probably most people, what the world's leading Wall Street trading operation does is a total mystery, right?
Mm-hmm.
but leading that effort, rising to the level that all of this is you're trying to actually run this effort. Are there takeaways for people trying to lead anything? Is there something that we can all understand from being in charge of this whole effort?
I think there's a lot you can take away, but I'm not sure it's that much different in running a trading desk or running a sales desk or running any type of big institution. You know, sort of the management tactics are similar. The one difference in running a sort of trading desk is the feedback loop is real time.
Yeah.
You think about it. You have a trader on a trading desk. They make a price. They trade. And within seconds, you know if they're making money or losing money. Right. So the feedback loop is real time. And, you know, they make a price and someone happens to buy something from them. They make the next price. Someone happens to buy something from them. Like, okay, they now have to figure out how to go buy those back in the market. And price is probably going higher really quickly. And they're probably losing money. So the only difference in perception in running a trading desk than running any other business is that the response feedback loop is actually real time.
Fascinating.
Versus if you're running, you know, a sales desk at a big Fortune 500 company that's in a B2B business, you know, you could be seeing a client for 6 months or a year to try and make a big sale. The feedback loop could be over months or years. So that's really the only difference. And go ahead.
Well, how about the feedback loop? If you're a mayor or a governor or a cabinet secretary. Because it's clearly much more loosey-goosey there, right?
Yes and no. So in the general times, the feedback loop is loosey-goosey. I agree. It's like you're trying to read tea leaves, and if you're trying to get reelected or you're in an election cycle, you're probably trying to read, you know, the political tea leaves, the popularity tea leaves, the polling tea leaves. But if you're in sort of a legislative cycle, like if you're really trying to get a piece of legislation done, I don't care if you're a mayor, you're a governor, and you sort of say, okay, it's Monday, we're calling the question, and I got to get my legislator to vote this week, then you're in that sort of different cycle. Mm-hmm. So it more ebbs and flows based on what you're trying to get done. But I would say holistically, you're right. It's a longer feedback loop. And at the end of the day, you're appealing to your constituents. But you're appealing to your constituents. Sometimes you actually have to get legislation done. And when you're getting legislation done, it's a much shorter window. You know, the line in Washington used to be, you know, you've got till when they land on Monday night till they start smelling jet fumes on Thursday to get something done. Right. You know, that's your congressional window.
But maybe in a larger sense, one of the big takeaways is by one means or another, accountability is important. We need to figure out whether what we're doing is in fact working.
Yeah. No, I look, accountability is important.
Yeah.
And no matter what business you're in, and I would say that governors, mayors, congressmen, senators, they're accountable.
Sure.
At the end of the day, they have a record of accomplishments or no accomplishments to run on. And sometimes running on no accomplishments is easier than running on accomplishments. You know, it's you know, a little maybe too inside Washington, but there's a lot of times where one party is trying to force the other side to vote on something because it's quote unquote let's make them take a tough vote.
Yeah.
Let's get them on the record to how they voted for X, Y, or Z. Like the outcome of that vote is never in question, but the record of that vote is pretty good political fodder in the next campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to use that in the commercials. you're talking some now about public service and which is another big part of your career. But love to hear. We talked some about the fearlessness in when you started your career. Was there fear as you started your public service career moving from Goldman Sachs, and then, you know, what was your motivating factor to want to take this big change on in your life?
So I wasn't looking to leave Goldman Sachs. I mean, when I went to see the then president-elect, it was presented to me that I was coming in to give him a update on the U.S. economy. And I had given the team an update on the U.S. economy in August prior to what was supposed to be the first debate at Hofstra, which was supposed to be the economic debate.
Yep.
That I'm not sure there was one economic question asked.
But, right.
Or maybe there was an economic question asked. There wasn't an economic
answer.
There wasn't an economic answer. So it didn't seem unusual to me that having spent a couple hours with the team in August on the economy and sort of briefed them on the big issues, that, you know, once president was elect, that they would invite me in and say, hey, and they said, hey, can you come in and do what you did for us in August, just in a shorter version? Give us the, you know, 15 to 30 minute version of the 2 hours. I said, the president-elect of the United States. Of course, I'm going to go in.
Yeah.
So that was what I thought I was going to do. And that turned into a bit of a conversation of the president-elect saying, you know, this is all well and good and really, really interesting stuff, but you're going to work for me. You know, and in a funny way, I said, you know, look, sir, I'm extremely flattered. But I have one, I literally think I have one of the best jobs in America.
Yeah.
Yeah, if not the best, I might have one of the best jobs in America. And I love what I'm doing, and I'm really happy. So, you know, obviously one thing leads to another. And, you know, my 15 to 20 minute meeting on the economy turned into a job interview. And we started, in many respects, negotiating, which was not at all what I was prepared to do. We started negotiating on what I would do in the new administration while I'm sitting there going, I'm really happy with what, like I'm pretty happy doing what I'm doing today. And I don't know how I'm going to deal with this. I got a wife and two daughters at home.
This is escalating quickly.
I don't know how this conversation's going to go. Yeah. So, you know, in my very well trained self, I'm going, you've got to get yourself out of this meeting.
Wow.
Which is what I did. I got myself out of that meeting. You know, I think we got to the point where it's like, okay, you know, this is really interesting. Let me think about it.
Well, we're here with, you know, Colin Clark here is our director in economic growth that's really talking a lot about opportunity. And, you know, there's such great opportunity in the United States because of our great entrepreneurship. And what emerging technologies do you think are really going to be the forefront of what's going to be changing us next and where we're going to be finding this opportunity?
So we just talked on the main stage. We talked a lot about blockchain. And, you know, like I think when you mention blockchain to a lot of people, they think crypto. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking crypto at all. I'm not talking NFTs at all. So that
should I go buy that baseball card NFT?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't know if you guys have been watching the Jack Dorsey NFT.
No, I have not.
Yeah, so we could tell that interesting story.
Of his first tweet?
His first tweet.
I've heard a little bit of this. I'm not watching it closely.
So there's no shock value there, but we won't go down there.
You're not in the bidding for that.
No, I wouldn't even know how to bid. Look, I don't own any crypto to buy anything in the crypto market, so that, I wouldn't be able to be in the bidding for that.
Right.
How's that?
But you're bullish on blockchain.
So no, the blockchain as a utility, I think has enormous value, and it really can change the functionality of things that we all do on a fairly daily basis, and it can open up financial markets for the underserved in many ways. That, along with digital fiat currencies, could have dramatic effects on banking the unbanked in this country. It could make many of the processes that we all find silly and arduous, like buying a home, much simpler. You know, the idea that you go buy a home and you have to pay someone to go research the title, and then you have to pay someone title insurance to make sure they researched it well. And then you could sell me the house next week. And guess what I have to do? I have to pay someone to go research the title. And then I have to pay someone for title insurance. Mm-hmm. Just think if that were in a digital, imputable blockchain where literally all that history was just sitting in there and we would digitally transfer the title to the house. We wouldn't have to go through that process. We could literally transfer title to a house real time. And we could save all that friction and we could save all that cost. And we would all know that we had the perfect history of what went on in that physical asset. That to me sounds like a bit of a fundamental change that clearly should happen.
Okay, so you've said that it can happen and it should happen. Do you think that Goldman Sachs and other leading financial institutions are on the verge of making it happen? Are they pouring investment into this effort? And of course, I know a lot of early stage companies are doing so. How's this actually going to play out over the next several years?
Well, I think you're right. Right now, and that's the way most of these things happen, you get disruptors that come in and disrupt. And so there are people disrupting and trading mortgages and pools of mortgages on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And settling them on the blockchain. And as they expand their client base and they start penetrating into the clients that the JP Morgan's, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup's, Goldman Sachs's cover, they're sort of forcing the hands of those bigger financial institutions, more regulated, to go down that path. The regulated financial institutions tend to be followers, not leaders, because dealing with the regulators on this is actually tough. Regulators tend to be very tough when you're leading edge. So in many respects, it's going to be much easier for the bigger financial institutions to follow. And look, we've seen this. How many digital payment platforms have we seen in the world? So, you know, JP Morgan has their own digital payment platform, but a decade plus after many of us were subscribed to other digital payment platforms that exist in the world, and they finally, after it became more commonplace, and they could point to these platforms existing and them working perfectly, they were prepared to take the sort of regulatory risk that you would have to take to be involved in those businesses.
Are we going to see, when we saw mobile apps and mobile, like a lot of the location-based services, like Uber, for instance, faced a lot of regulatory issues in different cities where are you a taxi? Are you not a taxi? How do you get regulated? Are we, from a policy standpoint, ready for this kind of technology, or are we going to be playing catch-up like we did then?
So we're always going to be playing catch-up. The regulator is never going to be forward-leaning. Mm-hmm. You know, regulators, because they regulate, right, because they can, are always going to be slower moving. Mm-hmm. You know, they wouldn't think it's their job to lead financial institutions. It's their job to follow and sort of hold back.
Right.
So I think the regulatory community and the regulated banks will always be playing catch up. And the regulated institutions will be talking to their regulators. And by the way, these regulated banks have, you know, multiple regulators.
Right.
They'll be saying, hey, look, this is going on. It's growing dramatically in the unregulated market. I would think you, as my regulator, would like to see this enter the regulated market. Why don't you allow me to get into that space? And I can show you the data, I can show you the information, I can show you everything that's going on. So it's always a follower role, not a leader role.
I'd love to ask you about another area where there is amazing innovation and a whole lot of regulation, and that's medical technology. Because I think you're an investor in some med tech companies. So there are two, I guess it's a two-part question. One is, what innovations are really exciting there? What's going to change the world and, you know, really help humanity a whole lot? And on the other hand, is regulation, have we kind of figured this out right, or do we need to make some tweaks to that as well?
Well, again, as you point out, highly, highly regulated. Yeah. You can basically take an existing system, completely modernize it, and you still have to go through a very arduous FDA approval process. Whether it's a, you know, a 501 process or a regular process, where you're literally taking something that has existed for years and years and years, and you're making it substantially better, you still have to go through these processes. Now, look, I'm not telling you shouldn't have to go through these processes, because like, if they're taking something in the operating room and they're using it, look, the regulator does have some responsibility to make sure that the product works, and it's not going to do harm, but it does make the barriers to entry in these spaces very high.
Look, I read some news that was really troubling to me on this front. Love your thoughts. It's just in one state, but perhaps it could go nationally. California, I think they're actually talking about some legislative changes, regulatory changes that would basically mean doctors could lose their licenses for essentially suggesting ideas, including to their colleagues, that weren't already FDA approved, weren't already fully established, but the doctors think they're on to something. They think they're seeing something with the patients, and we probably ought to try this sort of thing more. Are we really at risk of chilling innovation?
So you're talking about off-label
drugs?
Yeah. Look, you're way out over my expertise. I'm not a chemist. I'm not a doctor. Okay. But, you know, as we all know, you know, creativity is the mother of innovation.
Yeah.
So if a doctor thinks something can be used differently and his patient understands it, I'm not sure that I would stifle that creativity. A lot of the drugs that we have, especially in the cancer world, and like I said, I'm out over my skis in the cancer world, so they're not completely even sure how to use them, what doses to use. They're always tweaking these things. So to the extent that there's a mathematical formula for everything, I'm not sure that really exists. So it sounds to me like that's going way too far.
I hope so. I mean, in a larger sense, I think it speaks to an issue of, we always have this pendulum, but is the pendulum at risk of swinging too hard in the direction of avoiding risk and imagining we can create a kind of totally safe and stable world?
Well, I would hope the pendulum doesn't swing that far. You know, I think one of the big issues, if we want to talk about this generation today, we are morphing more and more to a culture of a riskless culture. Huh. Everyone wants a riskless culture. You know, you talk to people today, you talk to younger people in their career, they want sort of the riskless path. They don't want to take the risk. They don't want to take the high-risk job. They want
get
to
get in a taxi cab.
They don't want to get in the taxi cab. They don't want to say, yes, I can do that, if they're not 100% sure they can do it. You know, I said I could do something completely. I had no idea. By the time I showed up 3 days later, they thought I could do it. So, you know, it worked.
I hope a whole lot of young people hear your message about not being afraid to fail.
Yeah.
We learn from failure. We pick ourselves up and we go on and try the next thing.
We do.
And that should not scare young people.
It shouldn't scare anyone. It shouldn't scare anyone. You know, look, I don't think anyone succeeds in this life without failing many times. Yeah. As I've told many people, bad things are going to happen to everyone. It's really what changes your path is how you react to it. Like, when something bad happens, is it going to alter your life negatively or alter your life positively? Is it a learning experience? Is it a teaching moment? Or is it a moment where you, like, start questioning everything? You know, to me, when something bad happens or it's a failure moment, it's got to be a teaching moment. It's got to be a learning moment. You've got to say, hey, look, okay, I know when I do X, Y happens, and I don't ever want to see Y again.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a little bit, we back earlier, we were talking about the trading. Like, the trading feedback, you know, when I do X, Y happens. Ooh, we're never going to do X again. Yeah.
But nobody ever shows up in charge of Goldman Sachs and says, hey, to all the traders, please don't take any risks at all.
No, not at all.
That would be a losing proposition.
That would be a losing proposition, and shareholders would not want to own that stock. Because at the end of the day, the firm is carrying around enough risk capital to take risk.
Yep. Well, Gary, thank you again so much for spending a little time with us here. I know you've got a busy day and are have a lot of better things to do with your time, probably, but really appreciate that you wanted to spend it with us. So thank you so much.
Talking to you guys was fun. This could be the highlight of the day.
Well, I'm you know, you're also talking to the catalyst here in a minute, and that's probably going to be a lot more riveting.
And you already talked to me on the stage. Right. Hopefully, there's
a lot of
time.
Like, as I say, I'm just going from you know, microphone to microphone.
That's right.
Well, we try to make it fun for our guests at the Bush Center.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Been great. Thanks,
guys.
Thanks
so much. You can learn more about the 2022 Forum on Leadership at www.bushcenter.org/forum-on-leadership. And learn more about the Bush Institute's work in economic growth at www.bushcenter.org/economic-growth. We'd love to hear your feedback. Drop us a note on social media at the Bush Center on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for listening.